From corporate e-commerce to Bitcoin infrastructure builder, today we sit down with Rosa Shores, CEO of Blockspaces, to talk Bitcoin as collateral, the importance of community banking, and why Blockspace scarcity changes everything. Let's get into it. As a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. If you enjoy our content, please remember to like, share, or comment, as this all helps us greatly.
This isn't for everyone. It's for the ones who know the old system is broken and are ready to build something that lasts. Welcome to the Build with Bitcoin podcast.
I'm co-host Israel Munoz, joined with co-host Lynn Bairstow. Today we have the pleasure of welcoming CEO and founder of Blockspaces, Rosa Shores. We'll get into what Blockspaces does. It's a very interesting topic and conversation that we have for today. But first of all, welcome, Rosa. It's great to have you on the podcast.
It's great to be here. Long overdue, for sure.
We usually like to start out with getting to know a little bit about you and your journey as to how you get started with Blockspaces. But can you give us an introduction, especially how you became introduced to Bitcoin? Like, what was it about Bitcoin that attracted you, that kind of grew into leading to all of your time and attention being spent in the Bitcoin space?
Yeah. So I have to go back a little bit. and date myself. So actually in the mid to late 90s, I was actually in the broadcast division of Home Shopping Network. And so I was very much focused on allocating airtime I was working with the buyers to allocate airtime. Coming kind of from a retail background, you put product based on floor space to maximize, to maximize traffic and to maximize product. With HSN, which we called Entertainment Retail, it was how do you maximize airtime? So I was in charge of putting together shows that maximized airtime. And I was actually there when HSN was proposed to buy HSN.com. And I was sitting actually in the executive boardroom when the executives got brought this idea of selling online or this .com environment, and they all laughed at it. They all scoffed at it. They thought it was ridiculous that no one was ever going to buy clothes or perfume or jewelry online. You can't touch it. You can't feel it. You can't see it. And so they bought HSN.com, but they kind of disregarded it. So flash forward to what I call my second tour of duty at HSN. I was in the e-commerce division, and it was interesting because what they had said was going to disappear and was completely irrelevant had now become 70% of their business. So e-commerce was 70% of their business. So I had kind of lived through this whole scoffing at technology that's going to make things better and more efficient. That's where I was in 2012 when I first heard about Bitcoin. So I was actually in the e-commerce division as a digital analyst for HSN. And we were really focused on, when I first heard about Bitcoin, we were really focused on one-touch payment processing in a shopping cart environment. Like, how can we increase conversion in a shopping cart environment with just making it really easy to pay from the shopping cart? And that was kind of like all the buzz and all the rage and what we were trying to kind of maximize. When I first heard about Bitcoin, it took me a little bit to understand it. I thought it was kind of like that something you used like in video games or something. It really didn't make a lot of sense to me. But once I started kind of putting the pieces together about what it was and what it kind of enabled and this kind of notion of digital cash, being able to actually work without credit cards or without all of that complexity. And again, I was thinking more from like an enterprise or, how can we use it in a shopping cart environment? It was like, that would really simplify that because you wouldn't have to worry about credit card information. You could just use it literally like digital cash. But that was 2012. So it was very early days. I mean, I actually tried to talk to executives at HSN about Bitcoin in 2014, probably. And they were like, I don't even know what you're talking about. So it was very, very early, but it was something to me. And I felt like the kind of the reaction and the feedback that the world was kind of giving to Bitcoin reminded me of .com and how they kind of scoffed at it in the 90s. And it was like, this is going to happen again. It's so clearly obvious that it's early, but it's so clearly obvious that you don't kind of just push technology like that back where it came from. It's going to continue to expand. It's going to continue to mature. And so it's not something that is going to go away. And so it got me very interested, not just in Bitcoin, but really in blockchain at that time. And I was, and we can talk about my evolution there, but I was definitely, there was a time period that I was like, I was one of those blockchain, not Bitcoin people for a while, because I felt like the underlying technology could solve so many business problems. And my hat was always around, how can we use this technology to solve business problems? I was never what I would call, and I'm still not what I would call, somebody that is like super involved in the back and forth in the space. I'm not like crazy active on, you know, Bitcoin Twitter or anything like that. I just think of it like, how can we use this to solve business problems? How can we integrate it into business? How can it make things more efficient? What can we do to solve business problems? That's always kind of been my hat. And we can go on from there, but that was kind of my first introduction to Bitcoin. We became very interested in, like I said, blockchain and how blockchain could be used. My first Bitcoin conference was in 2014. It was called Bitcoin on the Beltway. It was 4 months after Vitalik, you know, introduced Ethereum in 2014 at the Miami conference. And then he actually did a whole presentation. It was just a few months later at that conference, you know, he introduced the Ethereum project. So I felt like there was a lot of innovation happening in the space, not just on Bitcoin, but on Ethereum and some of these other use cases that I felt were really fascinating.
And then what was that evolution to fast forward from roughly 2014 to, you know, to starting Block Spaces and, of course, sure, focusing on Bitcoin?
Yeah. So in 2014, my co-founder and I were really kind of the only people that knew each other that were kind of going back and forth talking about this, unless you got on a plane and traveled somewhere. And so we were like, you know, what can we do? We feel like there's a lot of interest in the community. What can we do to kind of like encourage people to come together and talk about this? Can we talk to other people? And so we actually started the Bitcoin meetups in Tampa in 2014. That is still, Tampa Bay Bitcoin is still the longest running and most active Bitcoin meetup in the world. I think we've had close to 1,000 meetups now. Still every Wednesday night. So, you know, that kind of was the impetus of, you know, us really starting to dig into all of the innovation that was happening, all of the use cases that were happening. Founders were coming to our, you know, potential founders were coming to our meetups. We had tons of developers coming to our meetups wanting to learn these kinds of systems. We had lots and lots of business owners coming to our meetups. And so that continued on. I was still at HSN until 2017, 2018. We did our grand opening in 2018. We really opened as sort of like Bitcoin Park. I think we were kind of like the original Bitcoin Park, where we had a lot of people coming together. It was almost like a innovation hub or a co-work space for, you know, Bitcoin projects and blockchain projects. And we had a lot of people working out of that space. As we were doing that, we started to have a lot of business owners coming to the space because they knew all the developers were in our space and talking to us about, and in 2018, this is like, you're talking about now Ethereum is, you know, somewhat in full swing. You're also talking about that the Hyperledger project was launched, which was, you know, kind of the Linux Foundation's first fully permissioned private blockchain. Lots of business use cases around that. We were talking to very large companies about supply chain and digital ID and all of these kinds of use cases around blockchain just in general. And Bitcoin always there, but a lot of these really interesting and fascinating use cases with blockchain. And so we actually had a very large kind of custom dev shop that's here locally, like came to us and said, we have so many institutions that are interested in blockchain. Can you guys kind of be our blockchain bench and come out and do these kind of custom projects with us? And so we started doing that in 2018. We did quite a few projects. We did a couple of government projects around digital ID. We worked with University of South Florida. We did some very large supply chain projects. So we were deeply understanding of what was going on just in the blockchain space in general. And we always felt like that was something that the Bitcoin space was kind of ignoring. Like, and still even to this day, if you talk to Bitcoin maxis, who I love, but they're still very much in the bubble of it's not so much, I think Bitcoin is the best and we'll get into that, but it's more about you can't be blind to all of the other innovation that's happening in this space. And I think in some ways, some of these other protocols have put forth projects that are actually being used in business still to this day. I mean, you know, for the most part, people would say, oh, Hyperledger is just a private permission blockchain. It's nothing more than a glorified, you know, database. But there are a lot of business problems that can be solved with a glorified database. I mean, like a lot. There are some huge inefficiencies within businesses today that need a database update. So while that's not radical innovation, it's still needed. And so, you know, it's this technology that does allow to solve a lot of business problems. So as we were doing those, custom projects, we had a lot of these large institutions saying what we really would love to have more than anything is to not have to get somebody from the outside to come in and build us a custom project. We don't want IBM to come in and do a custom project and then go away and now we're tied to IBM forever, or even you guys. What we really want is some sort of ability for our in-house developers to easily integrate whatever blockchain protocol they want to work on, build custom applications in-house, and then integrate them up into our legacy systems, because that's what they do on a normal day anyway. They're building in-house applications, and then they're tying them into our legacy systems to make our systems more efficient. And so at that time and still today, there's a platform called MuleSoft that's very familiar to enterprise developers, that allow enterprise developers to like easily connect, you know, infrastructure to integrations and build custom applications. So somebody said to us, what we need is like a MuleSoft of blockchain. And so we had this deep understanding of many different blockchain protocols. We'd been supporting these for years, you know, theoretically, and building on top of them. And so we set out to build that. We set out to build the MuleSoft of blockchain. So we wanted to build a developer tool that easily integrated any blockchain network that a developer wanted to build custom in-house applications and then pull them up into their legacy applications. So really from the start, our core has been infrastructure and integrations. Like, how can we support the infrastructure that's so complex? How can we easily let businesses integrate it into their existing systems? I think a lot of Bitcoiners think that the focus should be rip and replace and build something whole and new, which I think will ultimately get there. But in the meantime, you have decades of kind of integration. Like, how can these things easily be applied to, you know, existing systems? So infrastructure and integrations has kind of always been our jam. That's kind of always where we sat. And so we started building out what we said was the MuleSoft of blockchain. That's what we raised our first two rounds of capital to build. And in that, we were building, like, it literally was an enterprise developer tool that they could somewhat pick whatever blockchain they wanted to build on, because we felt these blockchains were kind of custom built for certain business use cases, and then easily integrate them up into their systems. In order to do that, we had to support all of those blockchain protocols. So at our peak, while we were building out our developer tool, we were supporting 40 different blockchain protocols. And by supporting, I mean, we were running 11,000 nodes. At our peak, we ran 11,000 nodes in like six different data centers across 40 different blockchain protocols. And so we had a deep understanding of governance structure of these chains, of how often they halted, how often, you know, what the documentation was around these chains, what the consensus mechanisms were. I mean, we had a deep understanding of, we had to support 40 of them at all times. And then we were also, in some of those protocols, we were staking. So we had a deep understanding of, you know, the incentives that staking kind of lines up with, which is a little bit wildly different than what Bitcoin does. And so we started to understand at a very deep technical level what is out there and really what it is lacking from a really solid, stable infrastructure perspective.
I think that there are trade-offs between different blockchains and different technologies, and where Bitcoin may be less nimble and maybe less less fast in transacting as some other blockchains, it has that stability and it has that assurance. And in some cases for a business application, it may not matter that you can go back in time and alter the data and change that. It cannot be altered in the future, but where other blockchains can. But how did you get your head around the 40? And did you see during that time period that some of these would fail or would alter?
And I mean, it was certainty they would fail. And I'm telling you, there's some that are very popular now that I think will fail. So I don't want to name names. And I'm not saying that from a theoretical, I'm a Bitcoiner, so everything else. I'm telling you, we ran 40 different blockchain protocols. And I'm telling you, they're weak. And so, I didn't think that before we actually did that. How do we get our head around it? We had a team of 50 people. Half of those were DevOps engineers. I mean, we had to have a DevOps engineer assigned to each blockchain protocol. You know, and like I said, because a lot of those were proof of stake networks, part of our business model was a staking as a service. So we actually did staking. So I understand even from a governance and incentive perspective, the way that proof of stake networks, like incentivized behavior, is very, very different than proof of work. And it wasn't just a theoretical conversation. It was an actual, no, we're actually doing it every day. I'm like having to support this. I know how much this chain halts. I know how much we have to rewind it. I know how much it splits and soft forks. I know the documentation is lacking. I know the scalability issues. That's not a theoretical, I'm a Bitcoiner conversation. That's a no, we actually had practical experience with it. And, you know, in that, we of course were also supporting Lightning. We did the first Lightning integration into QuickBooks. It was one of the first things that we did. In fact, I think it might still be the only Lightning directly into QuickBooks integration. So my partner, Gabe, has always been very focused on Lightning. He thought it was just an amazing solution, layer two solution. Truly, he thinks the only real layer two solution that's truly native to Bitcoin for so many reasons. And so he had like this small kind of side research team that was doing nothing but focused on Lightning and how we can integrate Lightning and how we can focus on Lightning. So we also really understood Lightning through all of that. It was just one of the protocols that we supported. Payments was always something that businesses always wanted to solve. So it made sense for us to also support Lightning. So we had our own little kind of internal Lightning team that was working on everything that had to do with Lightning, how we could integrate it into infrastructure, always focused obviously on payments, thought it was a very elegant payment solution. But again, to obfuscate complexity from our customers, we were completely supporting Lightning, almost like in the early days, like an LSP, like a Lightning service provider. And so that was just part of the complexity that we supported for this kind of platform that we were building for developers. So we completely understood all the complexity of Lightning as well. We deeply understood it. We did all the liquidity management for our, all the channel liquidity management for our customers. We were actually using our own Bitcoin to fund the channels. So we deeply understood Lightning and how Lightning operated. And then 2022 happened. And then FTX collapsed and everything kind of blew up. And that was a crazy year for us. I mean, not only did everything kind of go sideways and we lost so much trust. The whole ecosystem took so many years, steps backwards because of 2022. And, just so much trust was gone and so many things revealed. And that was the first time that we kind of stepped back and said, you know, what just happened? Like, what actually happened? Like, what actually happened with FTX? Not, you know, from the headlines perspective, but what actually happened there? And that's when we started really understanding collateral management and risk management and how collateral management is risk management. And, you know, in that kind of painful time where we were trying to understand what went on and then really understanding rehypothecation, how these banks are rehypothecating things, how, you know, these wrapped assets are not actually on chain, that there's no risk management for these sorts of digital assets. That's when we started taking a step back. And while our other business was still going, we were kind of looking at, is there some way So all of these things along the way, I would never say they were pivots. They were more focuses, and they were more learnings that were like, that actually doesn't make sense to us anymore. And this deep understanding of some of the other chains and some of the other protocols, combined with what happened in 2022, combined with what we already knew about Lightning, could we separate Lightning nodes away from the network, because we understood the complexities, some of the complexities with Lightning as a payment network? Could we separate the nodes and build a collateral management system that was Bitcoin native and that could seamlessly move collateral back and forth in these channels, isolate Lightning channels away from the network, and just use them as bilateral channels to move collateral back and forth within the scope of like a smart contract functionality? So that's what we've been doing the last 2 years. We built smart contract functionality, embedded it alongside a Lightning node that moves collateral deterministically and programmatically, moves Bitcoin collateral back and forth in these channels. So you have kind of airtight Bitcoin-backed financial contracts. So that's been our evolution.
Lynn and I are partners at Baselayer Advisors, where we use our network of venture capital partners and startup founders to connect investors with unique opportunities within the Bitcoin innovation space. Alongside this, we help startup founders with their growth and fundraising. Visit our website's advisory section to learn more.
Fascinating background, Rosa. And hearing you explain how you got to where you are now makes a lot more sense with what you're building at Blockspace, is given your deep understanding of, you know, infrastructure and being able to integrate complex systems. And maybe just briefly, I very much agree with your kind of outlook on how will evolve Bitcoin and financial markets, because you're right, it's going to be a stepped approach. And I mean, you're not going to go from, you know, from black to white in a matter of years. It's going to have to integrate, of course, with traditional markets. And there are lots of aspects of traditional markets and some intermediation that's actually, you know, of course, healthy and good for society as well. So fascinating take on the evolution of Bitcoin's maturity over the next few years. And back to Blockspaces. So to maybe just contextualize exactly what you're building, because it can be a bit of a complex topic, especially since some of these markets you're building for don't exist yet.
Infrastructure that supports Bitcoin as collateral on a range of financial contracts. Forwards are a use case. Our actual first use case that is actually where we are in production right now is collateralized lending. So think of Blockspace Forwards as a contract type that we support. So is lending. So could be bit bonds. So these are contract types that live within ARC, which is our product. It stands for auto reconciled collateral contracts. So this is a API kind of driven infrastructure that can easily fit into any kind of infrastructure that these companies are already using. Let's just take the example of collateralized lending. We are not a lending platform. We are not a lender. We don't do lending. You don't come to our platform to get a loan, but you would go to a bank that's using our infrastructure to get a Bitcoin collateralized loan. So our infrastructure, for example, could empower a bank to offer Bitcoin collateralized loans in a regulated environment. So we are the infrastructure that allows these kinds of Bitcoin collateralized contracts, Bitcoin collateralized products for financial institutions. We are I don't want to say a plug-in, but we are an API-driven integration, so to speak, into those existing legacy systems. We're not competing from a retail perspective. We're enabling our customers to offer those kinds of Bitcoin collateralized products. We do think that Bitcoin will underlie the whole financial infrastructure. We do believe Bitcoin is going to be the monetary rails of the future. And I think Bitcoin has evolved and matured to the place that we can now have smart contract functionality on Bitcoin. We can have stable coins on Bitcoin. I think there's a lot going on with Bitcoin that makes some of these other protocol use cases kind of obsolete. Not the use case, but having to use a different protocol. I think it's going to all move to Bitcoin. And I think a lot of it has moved to Bitcoin more than most people realize.
Got it. So it's the pure infrastructure and collateral management side of things that you're solving for. And specifically, Rosa, then, I mean, are you anchoring to the Lightning Network, or how do you view these layer two versus layer one trade-offs?
Yeah, I mean, Lightning is, you know, to us and to my co-founder, Lightning is really kind of the only true layer two on Bitcoin, just because it uses Bitcoin primitives. It uses hash time lock contracts, which are kind of, you know, native to Bitcoin, or certainly an idea that uses Bitcoin primitives. And DLCs are too, but HTLCs, hash time lock contracts, are kind of what Lightning is built on top of. It's how it moves money. And so we've built using hash time lock contracts to make all of those things kind of native to Bitcoin. Layer twos, I have to be honest, like most of the ones that say they're layer twos, they're sidechains, they're bridges, they're wrapped Bitcoin. That's what you see a lot happening now. And to us, when you're building like true financial infrastructure, that's just adding kind of a risk, because you're either, you know, you have a bridge risk, or, you know, wrapped Bitcoin is just representation in a completely different ecosystem of Bitcoin. So there's the ability to do all these things natively on Bitcoin now. And we think Lightning is one of those things that really allows that to happen, you know, in its maximum capacity. So that is why we chose to build on Lightning.
It must be very confusing. Like, I know last year at the Bitcoin Vegas conference, walking the expo hall, I mean, you would have thought there were 100 different layer two companies out there.
Yeah. There are. There's 100 different layer two companies. Yes, that's right.
And I think Israel and I both share your sentiment that Lightning is the true layer two. You know, something like Arc.
Right.
Is maybe also adding in there. But how do you explain that to your clients? And and I also want to know who your clients are. So you talked about this could be kind of a back-end infrastructure for banking institutions, but who else would be, who are the Black Spaces clients? And when you talk to them, how hard is it for you to educate them on the difference between the purity of the Bitcoin time chain and what you're able to offer with Lightning versus these other solutions that are out there?
Yeah, I would say our most immediate folks are, like, ironically, community banks, like smaller banks that are actually trying now to kind of compete with what they thought was going to be a long time coming that now all of a sudden is here. And so they have, you know, they don't want to necessarily end up having to use, you know, anything from JP Morgan. I mean, they see themselves kind of not having a place if there's, you know, if JP Morgan has all the blockchains and all the coins and all the stable coins. And then they also see kind of like this rise of standalone lending platforms, and they're losing deposits to kind of like, you know, these kind of standalone unregulated lending platforms. So they see the market demand for these kinds of products, but they are very nervous about kind of being disintermediated, so to speak. And so even though in 2012, I never was like, oh, we're going to end up building infrastructure that makes banks stay alive, I actually feel like a world where there's no community banks and there's only JP Morgan, that's definitely not the world we want to be in either. And so we really feel like, you know, you lose community banks and smaller banks, you're losing, you know, 80% of agricultural loans, you're losing like these smaller institutions that are actually supporting communities. And so that's not a world we want to be in either. And banks provide stability. And I think that it becomes important to see Bitcoin, the mass adoption of Bitcoin, if you allow things like Bitcoin collateralized lending at your community bank, right? Like how many more people would actually trust it? So first of all, our customers don't, I would never necessarily get into that complexity. Our customers are, you know, when you talk about a community bank or a credit union, their interest is Bitcoin because the regulatory environment around Bitcoin is very, very clear. And so it becomes actually less complicated to say it's just Bitcoin. So there's a lot of regulatory concern about what they can and can't take. What is this defined? Is this a security? Is this a commodity? It just feels like Bitcoin has such clear definition. And it, in a world where none of it feels kind of safe or familiar, Bitcoin actually does. And so I think that sometimes the water gets muddied when you're trying to talk about all of the other protocols. None of our customers are coming to us going, explain the difference between all these other protocols and Bitcoin. They're kind of saying, I'm kind of just interested in Bitcoin because I understand it in a world where everything is a little confusing. So it actually makes it more simple that we're just talking about Bitcoin, and we can allow your bank to easily offer a Bitcoin collateralized loan. So you're not going to lose that deposit. You don't really have to do anything fancy. You don't have to rip out your old system and put in a new system. This just kind of integrates alongside your existing system, and now you can offer a Bitcoin collateralized loan. So it becomes like, it just becomes actually more simple and clear to them. I wouldn't get into all of that other stuff with them. You know, maybe if their tech team wanted to talk to my tech team, but honestly, community banks don't have like a really robust tech team either. So it really is, it simplifies it more that we're not dealing with a range of stable coins or a range of different kind of asset types. If that makes sense.
It does. And Bitcoin is the one from a regulatory perspective that all regulators have agreed is a commodity. So you're right. I mean, it removes a lot of the uncertainty to just focus on Bitcoin.
That's right. It does. And you know, I was one of the founding members of the Florida Blockchain Business Association. So we've been focused on reasonable regulation around crypto and this whole industry since 2018. I was one of the co-founders. And so, you know, that's continued on to this day. And you know, very good friends with Perry and Boring and all of the things that are happening up in Washington as well. So we stay right on top of that. That's super important to all of our customers is like, what is actually happening from a regulatory environment? What can I do and what can't I do? That's a big concern. I'm actually speaking at a bankers conference at the end of March, and there's a huge section of it just dedicated to the regulatory environment.
And I'm curious, Rosa, because you have a unique lens. You know, how would you define the state of the market from your point of view, specifically with regards to banking? I mean, I think most people are probably a little more familiar with, you know, the bigger, louder banks that are in the news, and, you know, they've kind of shifted from fighting Bitcoin and crypto to now maybe a little neutral and starting to explore different, you know, integrations and solutions, et cetera. But the smaller community banks that you're referring to, it sounds like they may be surprisingly, you know, ahead of the curve, maybe a little more nimble or innovative than some might expect. Is that right? Is that wrong?
I would say that's 100%. Definitely more nimble. And you know, I don't want to say nervous, but they're definitely feeling the pressure to understand and to have some sort of play. And I think that there's like this feeling of, you know, who do we trust? Those banks deal very relationship. They're very relationship focused. And so, you know, who do we trust? What is easy for us, but not necessarily simple, like kind of this whole notion of it's so easy. And it's just that kind of makes banks a little bit nervous. You know, it's like nothing is that simple, right? And so, you know, they want to understand, like, I think they're more open to understanding somebody that's not necessarily associated with the big, huge players. And that's not necessarily associated with the Coinbases of the world, who they kind of see as competition a little bit, and not necessarily associated with, you know, lending platforms that exist outside of regulated banking rails. And so I think that that's a space that is really kind of unmet that we're going to meet with this platform. Now, again, collateralized lending is a use case of this platform, but it's the one that we're feeling is the most immediate use case.
I'd like to just talk about what your perception is in terms of how this sort of Bitcoin-based lending could perhaps resolve some of the issues that we've had with traditional finance and financial systems like rehypothecation. And do you see some of these bad habits or risk, you know, potential pitfalls coming into Bitcoin-based lending? Or how can we set the groundwork to where we have a sounder financial future, you know, based on Bitcoin?
I think that you have to have infrastructure that supports that pristine asset and those pristine kind of practices, so to speak, right? Because if we just rebuild TradFi on Bitcoin or even blockchain rails, you know, there is kind of like this thought that it could be worse, right? Like, you don't want to necessarily rebuild it on something that's rebuild all the bad practices on something that's actually faster. I mean, you know, you're not talking about, you know, small cascading failures. You're talking about like immediate cascading failures if you're building it on these kind of digital asset rails, right? So I think it's very important to build infrastructure that supports better practices. That is kind of what ARC is. I mean, it's impossible to rehypothecate on ARC. It's absolutely impossible. The collateral is locked in channels almost like a vault, and the collateral is automatically moving back and forth to either side of the channel as the price of Bitcoin moves. The lender can see it. The borrower can see it. You literally cannot rehypothecate funds if you're using our product. So, you know, I think we have a really unique asset in Bitcoin that's not just the most pristine collateral for so many reasons. It actually can settle itself. And that it does not exist in traditional finance. You have, you know, you have your collateral assets sitting here and you have settlement happening here, the DTCC or whatever. It's like somewhere else, right? We actually, for the first time in history, have a pristine collateral that's its own settlement layer. And so if you're not taking advantage of that and all of the ability to completely do away with all of those bad practices intuitively on the settlement layer, then you're really not using Bitcoin to its full potential. And that is what we have done. We've created where you can actually have the collateral and the settlement layer be the same thing, which it already is in Bitcoin, but now you functionally have it, you know, in a platform, in a product. So I think it's incredibly important that we don't just mimic all the bad behaviors of TradFi, that we actually can build like new financial systems. And we think that we're a step in that direction. Does that make sense?
And for the block space forward use case, Rosa, yeah. can we get into that and maybe first set the stage? Because there's several layers to understanding, you know, Bitcoin. First is, you know, money, collateral, then, you know, the mining side. And then we're getting into an even, you know, maybe perhaps deeper topic, which is the block space side of things. So, yeah, can we stage that?
Yeah. So, I mean, the staging for that is fairly simplistic on the surface, which is block space is scarce. I mean, it's why Lightning exists in the first place, right? Like Lightning came about because of block space scarcity and the block size wars, which I was there for. So, I mean, it was all about what can we do to solve this idea or this reality that block space is scarce, and that if we can move transactions or we can move the movement of transactions and just settle on the chain, how much are we alleviating that block space scarcity? That's why Lightning exists, right? So this has been a conversation in Bitcoin for a long time. We've known always that block space is scarce, but we're moving in a world now where it's like, if we're talking about nation state adoption and we're talking about very large institutions getting transactions through, we're talking about mass adoption of Bitcoin and all of these things to happen, this becomes a completely different conversation about how valuable is block space. And if in Bob's opinion, Bob from Barefoot Mining, who originally kind of brought this idea to us, as I think he's bringing to a lot of people, is that if block space is that scarce, why wouldn't block space be a commodity just like Bitcoin? And in a future world, block space is potentially more scarce than Bitcoin. So, and we'll have institutions that need to make sure that transactions are getting processed at a certain time, you know, and we'll have miners that need to be able to predict out revenue that's not based on rewards. It's going to be all based on fees. So how can we predict out that revenue? So these are kind of like minor problems at the base, but it becomes institutional problems when there's a lot of institutions that are trying to process transactions. As we talked about before the call, it's sort of like it's hard to think about because we don't necessarily live in that world today, but that world is definitely coming. And it's been a problem for a very long time in Bitcoin, a problem that we've all known was coming. Like I said, it's why layer twos exist, right? Is because block space is scarce. So in its essence, that's kind of the thesis: is block space is scarce. It's going to become more scarce. In that world where block space is scarce and we've commoditized block space, there's a market for it. There's a market for forward contracts on blocks. It's like you have with any commodity. And so how do we build a block space forward market? And how does that even evolve? How does it even exist? And kind of at the core of that is, well, let's just say that world exists and there's block space forwards that exist. What is the infrastructure that's going to be able to support those kinds of contracts, like an actual fully delivered block space forward contract. And so ARC becomes that kind of infrastructure. It's Bitcoin native. It can manage collateral. It can have deterministic contracts. So we have to have the infrastructure first that would even support that kind of contract. So that's where our product and block spaces actually plays in that ecosystem. But that ecosystem of block space forwards involves miners, it involves institutions, it involves market makers, it involves hedge funds, it involves, you know, everything that would involve a emerging derivatives market. So that's a forward-looking play, but we believe very strongly that it's coming.
Rosa, I'd like you, for our audience who may not be as familiar with Blockspace itself and how it works. So Blockspace is basically determines which transactions are settled on the through Bitcoin. So in other words, if you and I have a transaction, and I want to buy a car from you and I have Bitcoin, I want to pay for it in Bitcoin. How does that settle on the Bitcoin blockchain? And what is Blockspace in terms of, and who determines what transactions actually fit into a block?
Yeah, well, that, you know, like for the most part, that's kind of, it's supposed to be random, right? So there's some protocols out there that make it a little less random. But, you know, every block, a blockchain is basically a block of transactions. That's why it's called a blockchain. It's a block and a chain of transactions. Each block is limited in its space. So you can only put a certain amount of transactions into each block. And with that theory, if there's many millions and millions of transactions, like what gets processed first? Well, right now it's set up to where you pay a fee. And if you want to make sure something gets in, you pay a higher fee or whatever. But there's a world where that's extremely expensive and very unpredictable. And so what happens when we have so many institutions needing to make sure a transaction, you know, when, like I said, we're not talking about a world where you're buying a cup of coffee. We're talking about like nation states that need to get transactions through, or huge corporations that need to make sure certain transactions or their whole financial system is based on it, right? Like, when is there a world in which we need to reserve block space? Like, I need to know that this transaction is going to get through on this date and be processed at this fee. And so it becomes like any other commodities market. Like I said, it's just, you know, think about what a blockchain is. It's blocks of data. And those transactions happen, you know, those blocks get processed every 10 minutes. And so for every 10 minutes, you only have a certain amount of transactions that can get on each block. And if you extrapolate that out, you know, Bob has all the math. Like it is very finite. And, you know, I don't know if that answers your question, but
yeah. And maybe you can also elaborate, like what would some of the reasons be that a transaction is chosen or excluded from Blockspace? It could be governmental. It could be, I know Bob talks about this sometimes too, that, you know, in a world where you have people choosing, you know, it could be politically motivated. If you're talking about sovereign funds, it could be corporations and corporate competition. It could be, that there's just not enough room. I mean, right now we have space and for most transactions to be included, but, you know, beyond the scarcity, there could be other reasons that you want to ensure that you have the ability to contract block space. So,
right.
I mean, that whole aspect fascinates me. It goes beyond, you know, how much room is there, but also to other motivations of including or excluding a transaction from the Bitcoin blockchain.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. And I, like, you know, like you mentioned, I don't think a lot of people think about this deeply because it doesn't feel like the world that we're in right now. But in some ways it is. I mean, you know, I think that Bob is very intent on allowing individual miners to create their own templates, which is, of course, his involvement with Ocean. And so I feel like there are problems with centralization of the miners right now. And I think that there's a world where we can potentially create, you know, we think about like, what is, we would never want to do this if it was like, is this going to be bad for Bitcoin in some kind of way? But we think centralization, miner centralization is not the best thing for Bitcoin. And so this is another path also that allows for miners to have a more level playing field on processing transactions, especially if there's a active forwards market that miners can participate in.
And You know, on timeline, Rosa, for someone who's listening to all of this and thinking, you know, wow, this sounds like it's way too into the future. How can you help explain, you know, where we sit in that cycle? I mean, how close are we to these markets actually being developed, to the block space?
We're developing it. We've already created a pricing model. Yeah, I mean, we've already started, you know, kind of initial legwork. You know, like I said, it's a big organization project more than it is, you know, let's block spaces, sit down and create a block space forward market. It has to be organized, like I said, across hedge funds, market makers, you know, miners, obviously. So there's a maturity aspect of it that just kind of has to happen and kind of naturally evolve. I mean, I think that you have to have kind of traders trading in a non-delivered fashion, block space forwards, you know, like cash settled forwards, where there's not a fully delivered aspect to it, meaning that you know, they're just trading and they're cash settling based on, you know, their trades or whatever. That's a lot more simplistic, but even that market doesn't exist. Fully delivered is like a whole different ball of wax. That's literally like, you know, the farmer that has his corn, like saying, I'm going to have these crops and you can buy them at this price in the future because I'm going to be able to deliver to you this many bushels of corn, right? Like that world, like that even concept of that world doesn't necessarily exist in Bitcoin today. So that, you know, but are we talking about 10 years from now? No. Are we talking 5? I don't think so either. I think within 5 years. Yeah.
What? I mean, you have such a great perspective.
I think the next halving is going to, with every halving, you're going to see, you know, the condensing of block space. And so, you know, it could be the next halving that we have a world where it's like, okay, this is a much more serious problem.
Yeah. You have such a great perspective and of where we're going. I mean, what else are you thinking in terms of capital markets and how you may evolve as an infrastructure provider, you know, focused on Bitcoin with the larger, you know, with different institutions and capital markets? Where else are you looking or seeing opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, I think bonds are really interesting. I mean, our infrastructure can support bonds as well, whether that's corporate bonds or, you know, which being somebody that's been here since 2012, I can't even believe we're talking about things like a Bitcoin strategic reserves and, you know, bit bonds and like all this kind of stuff. And those things are so far from actually happening, honestly. I mean, I'm just happy to see them in the headlines. That just seems crazy to me. But we can support corporate bonds, certainly. We've had people come to us even about, you know, I think a really interesting thing that's happening right now that we're seeing, you know, quite a few platforms pop up is these kind of either Bitcoin enhanced or Bitcoin backed mortgages, or some sort of mortgage play. We're working with a couple of people on that too, that I think that we'll be able to use our infrastructure. I mean, keep in mind our infrastructure is it's not necessarily use case driven. It's Bitcoin collateral, any kind of contract that you're using with Bitcoin collateral. So we have a couple of people that we're talking to that have some really interesting mortgage products that, you know, need collateral management. Having Bitcoin native cloud management is really important. The ability to launch Taproot assets on Lightning, you know, kind of natively on Bitcoin. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Tether announcement, whenever that was, that they're going to be bringing Tether to Bitcoin via Taproot assets on Lightning. So, I mean, you know, those are huge players. And I really think that what we're seeing is the beginning of everything moving to Bitcoin. And again, please understand, I'm not saying that as like a Bitcoin maxi that's just like, go Bitcoin, burn everything down in Bitcoin only. I'm really not like that. That's not really where my headspace is. I came to this conclusion based on a decade of exploring all the other use cases and understanding what all the other use cases are. And I think that there's still very interesting things going on with some of these other protocols. I mean, for example, Hyperledger, which is, you know, the Linux Foundation's private, permissioned, like, you know, expanded database or whatever you want to call it. There's 800 companies using Hyperledger right now, and they're huge, like Walmart. Like Walmart has 15 different ways it's using Hyperledger. So, you know, from everything from food safety to, you know, pharmaceutical tracking to everything else. So, you know, you can't be blind to like the innovation that is blockchain and all these different use cases, but Bitcoin is the monetary system. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's what makes everything kind of move, whether it's you're tracking mangoes or pharmaceuticals or whatever else, you still have to have this kind of digitally enabled monetary system. And so that to me is the most interesting, the most impactful. That to me, you know, changing the structure of the monetary system and the way that money moves is the most impactful thing that you can do with this technology. And, you know, to me, that's Bitcoin. And so, you know, those thoughts and ideas have come from a decade of experience and not just, you know, I'm trying to signal the Bitcoin community. Does that make sense?
And you have the credibility to back it up. I mean, you have worked on the other blockchains where a lot of people have not dove in and seen exactly what they do. It peeked behind the curtain.
We've built on those blockchain. I mean, we build a government digital ID project for Seminole County. And so, you know, and we didn't build it on Bitcoin. I mean, you know, we built it on Hyperledger. So, I mean, we've built on those other chains, and I understand why they've been favorable and why they'll continue to be favorable for some of these use cases. I think, you know, some of those other use cases are really interesting too, because, I mean, let's just take, you know, to kind of digress off of Bitcoin for a minute, but let's just take, I was actually an advisor at the University of Arkansas Blockchain Center of Excellence, which is actually kind of funded by Walmart. And, you know, so I'm super familiar with like some of the things that Walmart has going on with blockchain and has for many, many years. Like, for example, their invoice reconciliation by using a blockchain for some of their invoice problems has taken it down to like 70% of all invoices, you know, needed to be reconciled. It's now like 1%, right? Like these are huge efficiencies for these companies just by using kind of blockchain enabled systems. They've been able to easily identify when there's like, you know, a salmonella outbreak on romaine lettuce or with the mangoes or whatever, where it's taken it down from, it used to take them a week to identify where like one of those shipments come from. Now it takes them like seconds, right? Like those are huge efficiencies for these companies that they're not going to steer off of, right? Those are really interesting use cases, but there's still inefficiencies there that, for example, with invoice reconciliation, when you're dealing with like a private permission blockchain, you know, you have a lot of visibility and transparency to like the person who created the invoice and maybe the buyer, but you don't have true transparency to customers. You don't have like kind of this open system. You still have areas where human beings have to input data. And Bitcoin is so unique in that there's no real human involvement. My co-founder said to me the other day, he was like, Bitcoin is so interesting because it's the first system that kind of incentivize the people what to do, right? Whereas all these other systems, it's sort of like the people have to tell the system what to do. But Bitcoin is sort of like, I need more hash rate. I need more, you know, it's actually a system that truly incentivizes the human beings that are acting in the system, the miners, to do what it wants it to do, right? And that's kind of very unique. And so whenever you have human input or human data or a human being that somehow can manipulate the system in any way, you don't have a blockchain system that's truly working at its real potential. I think that some of the things that are coming for blockchain, AI-enabled blockchain, like completely do away with that. I think that's probably one of the most amazing and interesting things that I think is coming is AI enablement and kind of taking the people out where they can corrupt the system. And then you have like this fully autonomous system, you know, or payment system that is really uncorruptible from human beings. And that to me is really interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, ultimately, I think that's what Satoshi really solved for. That was his big innovation, is actually aligning incentives in this extremely elegant way that made it so that you don't have these, you know, points of attack. I mean, that's a whole separate topic, and it's a fascinating one. But I mean, to your point, yeah, I mean, ultimately, with a monetary system and software, which Bitcoin is both, I mean, it really all revolves around incentives, right? And if there are incentives for corruption to enter, we've proven time and time again that it will happen. And that's ultimately what Satoshi really kind of, you know, blew our mind and world with. And, you know, here we are, fast forward. And to your point on some of these markets developing quicker than some people may expect, Rosa, I mean, it's really interesting because you mentioned the halvening, and when you think about it, like either that or just some other massive players, you know, I don't know, maybe we get something like the Clarity Act passing through, and then all of a sudden, you know, these very large pools of capital and institutions start playing with this technology more actively. And like, I can definitely see your point where block space scarcity can become an issue and top of mind relatively quickly. And I mean, to that point, you guys recently closed a funding round this year, right, Rosa?
Last year.
And what can you give us as far as, you know, painting a picture of roadmap for block spaces, you know, let's say 2026 and 2027, what can people expect from the company?
Yep, we're going to expand more with collateralized lending, I think very much focused on community banks and credit unions, the smaller players in that kind of collateralized lending space, while simultaneously continuing to work on this block space forward, this kind of emerging opportunity around block space forwards. I think that really has a handful for us for the next couple of years. I think collateralized lending will obviously be the most popular thing on our roadmap this year. But I think that we have to get prepared for the forwards market. Like I mentioned, that involves some very kind of fundamental work. There's not even a pricing, like you don't even have a reliable pricing model around how do you even price block space into the future, right? So we've been actually working on that with somebody from MIT and, you know, how do we even develop this pricing model, which normally would kind of be in the hands of traders, right? Like that's not something that that's not something we would, as an infrastructure company, would necessarily do, but it's got to be out there. And so we're kind of developing this pricing model, kind of getting it into the hands of traders, see if they can build trading strategies around hash settled block space forward, just from a pricing perspective, just from trading perspective, right? Like that has to emerge before you start talking about a fully delivered market. So these are like, I wouldn't call them baby steps because we're moving as fast as we can, you know, but they have to be thoughtful. Like you don't want to mess that up. So we're being very thoughtful about it, very kind of systematic about it. We're not trying to rush anything because we want to do it right. We don't want to do anything that's bad for Bitcoin. We're thinking about it every step of the way. Like, you know, how would we even mechanically organize, you know, a group of miners that could deliver a fully delivered block space forward. These are questions that have to be very thoughtful because you don't want to do anything that's bad for Bitcoin. Yeah.
I love that. Rosa, you mentioned you were talking to the bankers, to a banking conference. Where else can people connect with you or talk with you, or where else will you be speaking in the coming months?
Oh, well, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm not speaking a ton these days. You know, we're so busy building. I'm in all the regular places. I'm on X, the Rosa Shores. I don't post a ton on there. I'm not really on there a ton. You can certainly reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn, Rosa Shores. You can reach me at Blockspaces, rosa@blockspaces.com. We would love to do a demo, talk more deeply about any of these problems. And, you know, we always just love, obviously, we have our Bitcoin meetup every Wednesday night. That's on meetup.com. We do that virtually on Wednesday night. There was a 501c3 that kind of, I don't want to say it spun out of Block Spaces because we don't really have anything to do with it, but it was kind of inspired by the Bitcoin meetup. It's called Bitcoin Bay. So I think it's the only registered 501c3 in the country now. It's out of Tampa, really focused on building a circular economy in Tampa. We work out of Arc Innovation, Kathy Woods Innovation Space in St. Petersburg, which is fantastic. It's been great to have their kind of research at our fingertips, and being able to kind of interact with her team has been wonderful. Bitcoin Bay works out of that same building. So maybe we'll be developing like our own little kind of Bitcoin park into St. Petersburg, Florida. But I'm pretty easy to find, and I'll always post if I'm going to be speaking somewhere.
And I have to ask, it's like, how can we encourage more women to be part of this space? If there's some words of advice that you would give?
Yeah, I've got a lot. So I was, 2012, I was the only woman at the Bitcoin meetup for many, many, many years. And there was women back then and there's women now. It is awesome to see like how many more women are in this space. I would love to see more women builders in this space, right? Like, and we have a lot of market and everybody has a place in all of it. All of the feminine energy is amazing, right? But I would love to see more like women founded companies that are actually like building, you know, building solutions, because I think women bring a perspective. I've never been one that's like, you know, women are down, you know, it's hard to raise capital if you're a woman. It's hard to raise capital if you're a startup. You know, I mean, it's like, it's just hard to raise capital. So, you know, I've never kind of been, I'm going to play the woman card, you know, in this space or anything like that. However, I do think women provide a really interesting perspective on, this is going to sound like a Miss America speech, but I really do mean it. You know, I'm a mom, and I think that like women provide this kind of like this kind of need to make the world a better place for the next generation that men have too. But I think women provide it from like a protective perspective that I think they build in ways that really always give that a lot of thoughtfulness. And so I think that we could really use some more of that in Bitcoin and just like in the world in general, but certainly in Bitcoin. Is like, how can we build really thoughtful things that actually aren't just about, you know, we all want to make money, but it's not just about yield or whatever. Like, these are things that we actually want. These are the worlds we want to leave to our children. And I think women kind of provide that in a way that is very thoughtful and reflective that I would just love to see more in the products that are served up in this space.
Beautiful answer.
Well, you love it, Rosa. I mean, an hour felt like it was way too short. There's just so much to get into, your wealth of knowledge. And hopefully we get a little more time with you, whether it's in Punta Mita or back on the podcast in a future date. But I mean, thank you so much for joining. I'm sure that the listeners got a lot out of this, just like Glenn and I did. It's a very interesting and important topic, and it's creeping up on us quicker than I think most of us realize. So I'm very appreciative of your time, everything you guys are doing at Block Spaces, and hope to catch up again soon.
Obviously. Thank you so much. It was really fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Build with Bitcoin. If you found it of value, please take a second to like, subscribe, or share. This helps the visibility and reach of our podcast so that more people are aware of the innovation happening in and around Bitcoin. It truly means a lot. I'd also like to take this opportunity to invite you to join us at an event that Israel and I are hosting, Meet to Tech Talks 2026. Taking place from October 25th to the 27th at the exclusive Punta Mita Resort in Mexico, this will be an intimate gathering of 125 invite-only participants exploring how the future of capital is being shaped by the intersection of Bitcoin, artificial intelligence, and energy. To request an invite or for more information, visit mitatechtalks.com. We hope you'll join us. And thanks again for being a part of the Build with Bitcoin community.